Holden Forum. My name is David Wee. I'm one of the summer teaching staff coordinators here at Holden this summer, and I'm the moderator for this evening. As you've heard from the announcements or seen on the board, our topic tonight, which has arisen from various class sessions and discussions and conversations that have been going on this week, is the question, is the church inclusive or exclusive in terms of its responses toward various groups of people who historically or presently have been what we sometimes call marginalized, that is, put out at the margins of things rather than at the center of how we operate in society or as a church. We have four presenters tonight. I'm going to ask each of them to talk for just 5 or 6 minutes to raise some of the issues that we should consider. And then we open up the topic to all of you here, and we invite all of you to participate. The one rule that we have in the Holden Forums is that we listen with care and respect to one another. We may find ourselves disagreeing on any topic, and that's just fine as long as we respect one another and engage in a conversation that can be fruitful for all of us. This topic, as with most topics at Holden Forums, is one that we can never hope to complete with satisfaction within an hour. I will be a timekeeper and will end the formal forum at about 10 o'clock. Doesn't mean that you have to stop talking at that time or have to leave the room, but we'll end it, and you may leave the room and continue the discussion tonight, tomorrow, next week, as long as you wish. I'll introduce the four presenters here, and also thank Grace and Liz for being our signers and interpreters. We're grateful that you're here to help us that way. And then I'll just have them take their turns to say a few things about who they are and what brings them to this topic. And then it'll be open to all of us. Bill Lockhart, Kathleen Fleury, Karen Herseth-Wee, and Ross Shoger. And I think we'll just go in the order in which you're seated here. So Bill, go ahead.
Do you want me to just introduce myself, or should we go ahead with our 5 minutes?
Say who you are and then do your bit.
Okay. My name is Bill Lockhart. I'm here this week with my wife, who is the coordinator of Deaf and Hard of Hearing Week. And during a staff get-together the other night, we were trying to figure out what a good topic for tonight would be. And David asked if we should do something on deafness, deaf and hard of hearing people. We have done that in the past. And I didn't feel that comfortable with doing that, just having the focus on deaf and hard of hearing people and issues. And the reason why, the main reason why, is because I've been going to Native American workshops this week. And as Catherine was raising issues, I couldn't help but see startling similarities between what many Native American people have gone through and what deaf and hard of hearing people go through with regard to prejudice, oppression, inclusion, and exclusion. And as I thought of that, I couldn't help but think that there are many groups that are excluded for various reasons, and that led me to think that what is it that makes us include or exclude anything? Here at Holden, I think there's a general feeling that we are a very inclusive group. Philosophically, I think that I'm a very liberal, inclusive guy, but in practice, I'm not. I mean, I'm actually rather conservative. I'm constantly telling my kid no. And no is a form of exclusion, and I think no is a form of maturity. I think no is really important. I think churches, families, organizations make decisions both practically and spiritually. In the area of disabilities, there's 43 million people in the United States who are considered disabled. 24 million of those are considered disabled because of some degree of hearing loss.
Excuse me, can we go back to that hearing loss percentage?
24 million. So that is more than half of 43 million. When we talk about inclusion and discrimination or exclusion, the terms are very difficult. What do they mean? The older disability laws, we now think were not inclusive, but one of the main terms was inclusion. And that is a main movement in school systems today to include children with disabilities. To ask the general deaf community what they think of inclusion is to say that it is the utter destruction of their entire culture. It is taking deaf children who do not generally fit with their families and their neighborhoods, and on the theory that you're taking them and keeping them in family and keeping them in neighborhoods, you put them in local schools, keeping them with a normal environment. What that really does oftentimes is it puts this kid in this island situation. That inclusion isolates that child. So I think it's important to know who's doing the including. Are we forcing the inclusion on people? In my workshops, if I have a minute left, I was trying to make a connection with the theory, the theme of the summer of listening, that old disability laws told disabled people what to do. They took care of them, they were patronistic, they were patronizing, and they were pitying. The new disability laws do something very interesting, and they say, if a person with disability comes into your classroom or into your work site, the first priority is that you are supposed to listen to what accommodation that person says they need to have equal opportunity. Now that's a big change. It could mean an interpreter, it could mean a different kind of interview application, it could mean God knows what. But you have to listen to them. You have to listen to people with disabilities, you have to bring in consultants to say, what do blind people need, what do deaf people need, what do these people need? It's a twist to listening. And I think that's a shift into what it really means to include and exclude, is to say, open up and listen first, and then try to take care of the practical affairs of where we do draw lines and deal with all that organizational stuff. I was thinking of, and one of the interpreters will jump on me, but what would Jesus do? And I think the idea of service is first to Jesus, not to try to figure out a grand plan, but to look to others and listen to others and serve them. We who think we can gain a grand plan, even if that plan is to follow Jesus, it's probably not what he might have wanted. No, no, don't follow me. Look to the people around you. And listen to them and serve them. And then I think we perhaps might be the most inclusive. I don't know.
Thanks, Bill. Kathleen?
Thank you. Just a little background. I served in the National Indian Lutheran Board.
Could you speak up a little?
Yes. I served on the National Indian Lutheran Board for about 10 years, which was an organization supported by the LCA, Lutheran Church, that addressed social injustice issues concerning the Native American population in the United States. It was a national organization. When the church reorganized in 1989, that organization became part of the Commission for Multicultural Ministry. And I served as a Native American representative on that board, churchwide board. And so when we talk about inclusiveness, that was a big term in 1989. And because I'm a lawyer, I'd like to read all this organization of the new church and the Constitution and so on and so forth. And basically, the ELCA Constitution mandated inclusiveness and non-discrimination and quota systems, which really turns a lot of people off. And so when we talk about being inclusive and what that meant to the Native Americans in the Lutheran Church, because we are the smallest number of people of color, I think that's the term that's used in the Constitution of the ELCA, that required that all boards be representative of our society, including women, including people of color and lay and clergy, so that it wasn't just dominated by clergy. I'm assuming that was the reason for this whole reorganization. So this inclusiveness means everybody. I served on that board for about three years. And that same time, it was a commission for multicultural ministry. The church also had a commission for women. Now, commission didn't have the same status in the structure of the church as other church and society, for example, or other parts of the church. And that bothered some of the groups, the women, and also the people of color. Because in a way, it was as if, okay, this is the commitment the church is making to people of color. I guess I won't deal with the women's issue, but it basically is the same. This is the commitment that we make. I think it was like a $2 million budget that would be to go to the Commission for Multicultural Ministry to try to achieve the goals of having 10% people of color in the new church. Well, first of all, there was some real strong objection by the church body to even having a commission for multicultural ministry, a special area commission that would deal with people of color and ministry and trying to get more people of color into the Lutheran church. And in the time, that was in 1989, and of course everybody knows the budget, all the pie-in-the-sky ideas of the new church and what would happen didn't happen. In fact, there have been major financial problems, and so now the Commission for Multicultural Ministry, and I understand the Commission for Women, those were the first parts of the church that were cut. And I guess as a Native American and being very much involved with Native American ministry, it's like, is this lip service? Is this lip service that we want to include you in our church? We want people of color. I'm expressing my opinion as a Native American and how we feel about it, because some of our Native American ministries, especially in Alaska, have not been supported by their synods. And of course I realize how that structure works, and the synods can do what they want in terms of budget cuts and so on and so forth. But it's created some real disenchantment with the Native American and Eskimo Lutherans in the church, in terms of what kind of support. I mean, was this tokenism? I guess that's what I think about. And even in state government, because I serve as a state official, and in our state, Montana, 6% of our population is Native American. We have the highest unemployment for Native Americans in the state of any group, and yet the state only employs 1% Native American. And I've researched that. Well, why? Well, first of all, their whole process of trying to attract and get Native Americans into the workforce is very discriminatory. It is totally culturally insensitive. The whole process is extremely intimidating, even the application process. So I often have people say, well, I'm the token Indian for the state, and sometimes I feel like that. And so in terms of the church, I feel also it's like, well, is this just tokenism? I mean, is this just a way to look good up front? You know, it's like, well, we have to kind of look like the society, but are we really sincere about including people of color into the church?
Thanks, Karen.
My name is Karen Herseth-Wee, and David and I are the teaching coordinators for this summer here at Holden Village. We live in Northfield, Minnesota. He teaches there, and I'm a secretary in the art department. We are parents of three children. One of the organizations that we're very involved in is called PFLAG. That's an acronym, Parents, Friends, Lesbians, and Gays. And I guess I feel like I am speaking on behalf of many parents about this issue here tonight. Is the church inclusive or exclusive? Each of us has about 5 minutes tonight, and I'm sure it could be a lot longer, to speak about our personal experience with marginalized people and how we perceive that the church behaves toward these people. 2 days ago, when Paul Olson had us brainstorm gospel concepts before we heard angry black poetry, we came up with the following as the central teaching of Jesus. Love. The gospel says, love your neighbor as yourself. Love your enemies. We agreed that Jesus said, where the least of you are, there I am also. And we agreed that Jesus, as the great example, came to turn our usual concepts upside down. I think about the church a lot these days and how its example and teaching has affected the life of our family since David and I learned that we are the parents of a lesbian daughter. Our daughter Allison is here in the community. Many of you know her. She cooks your meals. She chants Vespers. You visit with her at the kiosk on the patio. She is a gifted and wonderful child of God, and I know that God celebrates this person in your midst and in ours. But the church, and many church people. I offer you some firsthand observations. Tears puddle up in the eyes of a well-intentioned neighbor who says to us, oh, you poor people, I feel so sorry that your daughter is gay. One of Allison's fellow students at St. Olaf writes a hate editorial for the newspaper, the campus newspaper, which is directed toward the whole gay community. Our home congregation in Northfield recently refused to welcome to a basement meeting room on a weeknight Pastors Ruth Frost and Phyllis Zillhart, who are lesbian ministers in the city of San Francisco. They wished to come and tell us of their ministry to this AIDS-stricken city. I know that anyone speaking on special ministries to the poor, or to people in Africa, or to one of the South Dakota Native American reservations would have been welcome in our church basement. But these two women were not. One of my friends, a black woman poet, recently commented, racism is alive and well in America, but at least most people know it's not okay to be racist. But it is okay to be homophobic. Some people feel it's even biblical. You may notice that I do not use the term lifestyle in connection to speaking about the lives of gay, lesbian, and bisexual people, for theirs is not a lifestyle, it is a life. They do not choose this life like they may choose a home with two garages, or to have a sauna in their basement, or to be vegetarian. So where is the church in this matter? Where are we as representatives of the church? The same Bible verse in Leviticus that says a man should not lie with another man goes on to say we should not wear clothes of mixed fibers, And I do not hear the church speaking out against Orlon or polypropylene. Jesus says, wherever are the least of you, there I will be, and that we are to love all others as we love ourselves. I suspect that the church, we the church, will come around on this issue, but I don't expect it in my lifetime, and I am impatient. I want the church that I love to be a leader, not a follower, including marginalized people. Historically, right now, I do not find this leadership. Theologian James B. Nelson illuminates the Sodom and Gomorrah story as an ultimate irony. He says that this Old Testament story is really a story about lack of hospitality. Hospitality was a really big deal in those days. And the people of Sodom and Gomorrah refused to recognize the disguised God and two angels who came to the city. And they chose to treat them the worst that they could, treat them like women, rape them. This passage does not condemn same-sex love, but rape and inhospitality. This story has been used against a whole community of people by church people ever since. Hospitality is much on Holden's collective tongue these days, as it should be, but the church and we individuals who make up the church would do well to learn about hospitality, inclusiveness, toward the homosexual person, your and my neighbor, yes, even our daughter, our uncle, our grandparent, our mom.
Thank you. Ross?
I'm Ross Sugar, retired biology professor from Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. While here at Holden for my first visit, this is the second week of my first visit, I've been teaching on men's issues and this week on the issue of AIDS. I think why I'm interested in this is, first of all, I'm a biologist, but also because I touched and hugged my first person living with AIDS approximately 5 years ago. In our community, there are two young men, the age of Jan's and my oldest son, 33, both of whom are living with AIDS, but goodness knows how long they're going to be living. We're living in an interesting time where it's estimated that between 1 and 2 million persons are infected with the AIDS virus, HIV. The Center for Disease Control in Atlanta suggests that by the year 2000, that number will have risen to 4 million in spite of deaths. One person with AIDS dies in the United States every 12 minutes. Every 12 minutes. One person living with AIDS dies in the world every minute. If I can believe what was written, and I didn't go to try and do all of the calculations, more U.S. citizens died of AIDS in 1992 than in the 8 years of the Vietnamese War. It is estimated that 100 persons per day are infected with HIV. 50% of those dying of AIDS are under age 25. We are living in a world that is estimated to have 13 million HIV-infected people. The estimates, the projections to the year 2000 are highly varied, ranging from 40 to 110 million. AIDS presently is incurable, although treatment can prolong life. AIDS is preventable, but very difficultly so, because of the way in which we live. Individuals infected with the HIV virus do not know when they will die. Currently, they know that they will die. The average is about 9 years after infection until full-blown AIDS emerges. While there may have been some, I am not aware of any documented cases of remission. AIDS is visited upon people who already are marginalized in our society. 70% approximately of those living with AIDS are either gay men or individuals who are drug users, injection drug users, injecting drugs. The projections are that what we are going to see will be increased numbers of blacks and Hispanics in that community of those living with HIV. Are we, as the church, universal, the Lutheran church, I'm not Lutheran, I happen to be United Church of Christ, are we as local congregations listening, as Bill pointed out? But also, are we listening to the caretakers of these people? Caretakers who come in when family and friends abandon them. Families can't accept this. Friends are afraid of this. Who's left to care for them in their loneliness? What support are we providing for these people? I have to say that in my congregation, in my denomination, not a great deal. Not a great deal. Locally, yes. Denominationally, not all that much. The state of Minnesota and the Minnesota AIDS Project is probably doing more than the United Church of Christ is doing in Minnesota. Why? Is it that we're looking at these people as being repugnant, getting their just desserts? I mean, after all, look at the way they live. Are we afraid of them? Do they frighten us? Do they threaten us? Do we really acknowledge that they are children of God, as I think has been mentioned here already? Products of God's creation? I don't know. I'm asking these questions along with you.
Thanks to us, and thanks to all four of you. Be glad to now have any of you ask questions or make observations, responses. Forgive me if some of you who are behind, if I don't notice you, find some way to get my attention if you want to drop a pillow on my head or something. Let me know. Okay, does anyone want to follow up now with questions or observations?
I have a question.
Yes.
In your own communities, have you seen some signs of hope? In your work, have you seen some signs of hope? Are there some positives in this relatively bleak picture?
Can you all hear this?
No.
Okay.
Good. Some people said no, so maybe.
Oh, okay. The question was, can you see any signs of hope in your own communities and congregations?
In the issue that I am talking about, yes, I do, especially with this Parents Flag organization. I mean, there are lots of parents who care a lot about their kids, and they are beginning to be active in letting everyone else know. Trying to break down the secrecy between the heterosexual society and the homosexual society. So that, I mean, secrecy warps everything. It warps things within families, but it warps relationships between communities. And secrecy has been essential because people lose jobs, even their lives, over this issue. But the more that we can become not secret about it, the healthier we're all going to be.
I think with regard to people with disabilities, there's been a massive change. It's been a forced change. The Americans with Disabilities Act has had a tremendous impact on across the board. Hotels now do have TVs with decoders, phones that deaf people can use. Employers must hire interpreters under certain circumstances. You talk of secrecy. Intentional or unintentional. I think with disabilities, there was unintentional discrimination because there was not awareness of what the issues were. There was not awareness that sign language is the third most commonly used language in the United States. There's English, Spanish, and sign language. I mean, that's just, people weren't aware. People were not aware that for $200, you could buy a telecommunication device for the deaf that would make a deaf person suddenly able to be a salesperson, a community liaison, a secretary, a supervisor. Once, and a hotel by the same token, they can get room service, etc. Once that education is out there, there's much less reluctance to be discriminatory. I think the term discrimination is interesting because we usually see it as being negative and exclusive. You discriminated against me. But really, the term has a positive use. Discriminating tastes are positive tastes. So all our terms here overlap and cross, and it's the use of them that is interesting and can be turned to different advantages, I think.
Not very much, but our church has a committee on disabilities. We have a pastor, a counselor in the hospital who's in our church, and she just raised Holy Cane until we got the committee. And we have a person who could do sign, but we don't have any occasion yet. And we haven't done anything about it. But we do have all kinds of things happening in terms of physical disability. This woman actually participates in our dance choir. All kinds of things that are happening because she's there. But she had to be there. And she had to be aggressive and articulate.
Okay. Good. Do any of you have signs of hope and progress? From your experience?
I think the church in Wallingford in Seattle has staged a couple of years of the AIDS retreat for people living with AIDS, and they've grown, I think this year they're doing a double version of it.
I can't hear you.
The church that I belong to in Wallingford has staged an AIDS retreat, at least we're involved in it, we may not be the only church doing it, where people living with AIDS go to the retreat for a week every month in the fall, and that's doubled in size over the last year. That's been a really positive thing.
That's actually sponsored, that's a United Methodist event sponsored by the annual conference of United Methodist Church in Washington State and Northern Idaho. And so the conference is currently sponsoring two retreats for people with AIDS, one west of the mountains and one east of the mountains. And that's a really good way, I think, for churches to get involved in this, where there's medical staff provided, and the way is paid for the people to go. The money is raised through other sources, the various fundraisers, to allow people with AIDS to be able to go on a spiritually oriented retreat, because nobody else is doing this. People with AIDS really have been completely ignored by the churches. And if there's any group that I think desperately needs to be able to address their spiritual needs, it's people with AIDS.
Great. And our church is also a reconciling congregation. Michael, can you give the definition of that?
In the Methodist Church, it's the equivalent of the Reconciled in Christ program in the Lutheran Church. It's the United Methodist Church that welcomes gay men and lesbians into the full life of the congregation. Everything from serving on committees to teaching children Sunday schools to participating in communion. We perform same-sex covenant ceremonies. It's just a very important part of what our church is and what our church does.
I wanted to say that the one point of hope for the United Church of Christ is that we are in the process of encouraging congregations to become open and affirming congregations, which means the inclusion of gays and lesbian in all aspects. But this is asked that local congregations, through study and commitment, finally achieve this. The other thing I wanted to say is I think there's a strange irony when you begin to look at physical disabilities. We're in the process of rebuilding or adding a addition and remodeling our church building in Northfield. And while if this were a secular public building, we'd be required to put in an elevator. Churches aren't required to do so. We are dismissed from that legal responsibility. How strange.
Jan?
I just want to say about the open and affirming.
Okay. Sven?
To me, it's been hope, a sign of hope that the ELCA has decided that women and people of color and languages other than English must be on all committees and boards and councils. But I didn't, and I realized that is a token thing, but I didn't catch in your presentation that you saw it as a sign of hope.
Well, if I may respond to that, I believe that there has been a lot of changes and that there is a lot more awareness, and I was just reflecting on that. In fact, I believe that the voice of the Native Americans is being heard in church-wide. In fact, we have a Native American who serves on the church council, and we have Native Americans that are on church-wide boards that I think has had a very positive impact and has that our issues are being heard, which hasn't always happened. I guess my concern is, and I guess I have to get more specific, is that Indian ministry in Alaska and the largest indigenous people who are Lutherans is the Eskimos and that in Alaska, Alaskan Natives. And they are not being supported, and they have put out appeal nationally to people involved with Indian ministry because their Indian ministry program is being cut, which is very important. I mean, there isn't any support for it. And of course, that's a synod problem. And that is generalizing to say that the whole church, you know, is cutting all these programs. But I do hear this. I do attend the multicultural conferences that they have, I think, every 2 years. And there are concerns. But yes, I agree with you. It's wonderful to see, other than the language, other than English, in literature of the church, and that is a commitment. And so I think that is, I mean, there has been some very positive things that have happened, but maybe it's people that have been disenfranchised in a sense. It's like you want to see things happen faster. You'd like to see 10% of the people of color in the church, and that was kind of the mandate in the Constitution, and that hasn't happened. And in a sense, that has kind of been a disappointment because, and I don't know really what the reason is, but that's not happening. And it's like, I feel that because the Lutheran Church is, I don't know what percent people of color, maybe 5% total population, and they wanted 10%, maybe it's not even 5%. But it's like the church needs to go out and reach out to those people of color to bring them in. And I think a lot of people of color do not feel, I mean, like, they're not going to come to you and say, I want to be a part of your church. There has to be something that's will attract people of color into the church.
Yes.
I guess I'd like to use a little illustration from the mountains around here, and I think that, to me, this is where the church is. When you're climbing a mountain, those of you who have, you know how the top of the mountain keeps getting higher. The higher you go, it grows. Mm-hmm. You do have to turn around every once in a while and look down to see how far you've come. However, if we as a church are only looking down to see how far we've come and are not looking to see how much farther we need to go, I think that this is one of the things that's holding us back. We're patting ourselves on the back, and we're perpetuating, as one of my pastors said, a nice church with nice people dressed in nice clothes, sitting in church on a nice Sunday morning listening to a nice sermon. What could be nicer? What? We're so frightened that somebody of these many different groups that we are not really reaching out to is going to sully that image of a nice church. And we're supposedly evangelical, but we're not.
I remember.
Yes, back there first.
I'm just curious if the people on the panel can discuss the issue of mainstreaming versus specializing in trying to reach people of special that may not be included. Should the church specialize in churches for the gay community, the AIDS community, the Native American community, the disabled community, or should we work toward including them in existing, whatever you call it, mainline?
I don't think it's an either-or situation. I think a church like in Minneapolis, Spirit of the Lakes, which is a very vigorous community, mostly gay, lesbian, but not all, has grown so fast from its buildings that it has had to move 5 times in 7 years. What it tells me is that these people, they need a place to go, and they aren't finding it in most of our nice congregations, because they don't find the support that they need. I had a young man tell me his story about how he hadn't told his parents yet that he was gay. And he said, one of the reasons I haven't, he said, is that I don't want to be known as the gay cousin in the family. You know, I do lots of other things. I love to fly airplanes. I'm good in science. I'm a poet. I don't want to be the gay person. And so you don't want to stand out. You'd like to be included, but when that doesn't happen, you find a place where you don't stand out. And if you go into the gay community, you're one of everybody else. And so it's a very mixed problem. But the shoulds, I guess I didn't like the shoulds. What should we do? What should we do? I think to be including of all people and to bring up the topic so that it's not a topic that is never brought up. And that will help.
Just to follow on what she was saying. I'm a gay person and I go to a predominantly straight congregation, which is Longford United Methodist Church. I chose to go there partly because I didn't want to go to an all-gay church. There are gay people who do want to go to all-gay churches. I felt self-conscious, sort of hyper-aware of being gay when I was in an all-gay church, and felt more when I was at Wallingford that I was Michael, who, you know, works in a law office and does this and does that and serves on this committee and is also gay and has friends in this, and that was considered part of who I was. So that's the reason I have become as committed to this congregation as I have. And I think that environment, it's like you said, it shouldn't be an either or. For some people, one thing will work and for others, it won't. Like you were talking about the deaf, hard of hearing community, how there are instances where you don't want to assimilate people because They need to be with like individuals, but there are times when you do need to be in with other kinds of people, because you can learn from that, but there are times when you need like individuals.
Any other?
No. No. I would just add that whenever you're stuck, you ask the people what they would want. And what could be simpler, but it's what we've missed so much by thinking that we need to set things up for other people. Another part of it with people with disabilities is that the responsibility isn't the other guys all the time. The person with the disability has got to speak up. You know, the gay person. And then we have to listen. And then, when we say, we ain't got enough money for an elevator, they gotta listen. And it's the open dialogue that goes on, but it's the openness, not the exclusiveness, that then allows the inclusiveness or something like that. I hope that's on tape.
On the issue of AIDS, I think part of the reason people are hesitant to tell the people that they have AIDS or HIV positive is because of the ignorance and fear. And we had a very dear friend who was a medical doctor and in Minneapolis area, who on his own worked with the Catholic Church, would go around to educate people in the area about AIDS. And I know even in the medical community where I am, the fear is still there, the ignorance is still there, and that's part of the problem that they have to face.
Paul?
I was just going to point out that so often our decisions are filled with, or the results of our decisions anyhow, are filled with ambiguity, even moral ambiguity. And, I sometimes think there's no free lunch. I heard only recently that if you take out the curbs at a traffic intersection and put in ramps for wheelchairs, for the people who need wheelchairs, then what you've done is taken away one of the things that blind people need with a white cane, who feel for the curb when they come to an intersection. And here you're trying to be helpful to the one group and you're being not helpful to another group. And boy, that seems to me to be a parable of human life. But I hope we're not paralyzed by that, and I hope we could find some way to solve even that kind of thing.
I think one of the things that has come up in every one of these presentations, and most of what you have contributed, is education. Education, bottom line. We need to know more. And that's what happened in our family. We lived with a young lesbian woman for 20-some years, and we didn't know it. And we didn't know about that issue, what we should have known. And some of you have the choice not to learn about this issue. We didn't have the choice. We had to learn about it. And I think one could say that about all of these situations. And the more people who will take it upon themselves to become educated about these concerns on behalf of marginalized groups of people, the better off we're all going to be.
Kim.
I think that's a good point. I think that's also an excuse in many cases.
Education.
I have been the token woman. I have been the person whose programs have been cut out from under them and have been left floundering without funds. I have been the person in dialogue for years and years and years now, with no end in sight. And the reason always given is because we need more education. We need another study on the issue. We need more discussion on the issue.
Well, I hope that isn't what I was saying.
Well, in that sense, I think in some ways it's a joke often with people about with the Lutheran Church. It's a joke. You know, what do you do when you have a problem with the Lutheran Church? You set up a committee. You know, and then what do you do when the committee has not made a decision? Well, then you set another committee to study the issue why the committee has made a decision. Personally, I feel that the time is coming soon. Jesus said that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And we don't have time to sit around forever and study issues. I think there needs to be some discussion. And I need, beyond the discussion, I think there needs to be some action during the study.
Right, I agree.
And I guess what I would encourage people at home and villages just don't discuss it. Do something about it. And what I would ask the panel is, what do you see as possibilities for action on all the different issues within the denominations that you can say, okay, sure, we can discuss it, but meanwhile, you know, let's do something about it. Let's not close that church because you're saying you don't have funding. Well, okay, sure, we'll discuss the funding, but meanwhile, let's keep the church open and not kick those 80 people out on the street for Sundays.
I totally agree with you, Kim. And the situation with the ministers who were supposed to be able to come to St. John's Church of a Sunday was just that situation. They wanted to come and speak about their ministry. Our council and the ministers said, of course they're welcome. If we have someone for representing the church's point of view there to give the church's point of view. Well, they weren't coming to argue their position. They didn't want to do that. David and I hadn't accepted their invitation to come on that premise. And so we called them up and said, we don't want you to come under this. This is not hospitable. This is not your intent. And, you know, we just assumed you didn't come. It got even more contrived, and they ended up in our living room with a bunch of people. But, I mean, it was so awkward. And I agree with you that we just need to take steps. One of the things I'm very impatient with is the church not wanting gay lesbian people to be ministers. I think we should just decide they can be. That's action. Yeah. I mean, why a 3-year study? You know, we're back to your question.
No, that's a 3-year study after the ELCA's 4 years, the LCA's 4-year study.
Right.
And now this 3-year study is being postponed for another 4 years.
Right.
With the deaf and hard of hearing issues, they're just discussing now the need for a study.
Yeah.
Are there any other suggestions of action that can be taken?
I have a question here. The question is, though, who do you want to make these decisions? I mean, if we put you on the committee and say, you be the committee, then you'd probably be happy the way it came out. But you can't just say, let's just do something in the interim when there's no consensus on what we can just do in the interim.
Yeah,
unless we're going to say, we'll just do it as we have been doing it in the interim until we get some sense of where our direction is.
Well, I think there are situations where someone makes a decision about that. I mean, Harry Truman brought blacks into the military like that.
Yes.
And I think we could have done it with gays, too, if Clinton hadn't gotten so harassed on all fronts. And, I mean, harassment is the name of the game for that man in that office at this time, because nobody wants to, well, they want to study.
But I guess my point is we can talk about this, and we might even come to a consensus in this room. But there are people at the top who have to ultimately make these decisions. Now, maybe it's Harry Truman at that point saying, this is the decision I'm going to make. So that's a right decision then. But you might have people at the top who say, this is the decision I'm going to make, i.e. the Pope, who says, this is the way it's going to be. Well, we wouldn't like that any better if we were getting that dictate from the top. And we're not going to study it. The Pope will decide. We wouldn't like that in the church, I don't think.
Any other responses about things we can do?
Interpreters can keep up. Interpret for people overlapping.
Okay.
I think it's very nice to listen to all these specialty groups and complain about being budget cut. But how many people know other people that used to work for major corporations that had budget cuts? Let's face the fact of life. Why is there a budget cut at the church level? The reason is we as Christians as a whole have not been contributing enough money to fund everything. So as management, they have to make a decision how this money is going to be best used. And sometimes some of us are hurt. I was one that was personally involved with a merger, and I was put out on early retirement and had to flounder for a while. Now, there was nobody, no specialized group that was coming to my aid, but there's millions of people that have suffered this same type of thing, and they're getting younger and younger every year. It's just a matter of, if we're truly Christian, we're going to be putting enough money in the coffers to be able to take care of these things. So let's not discount that they're wrestling with some very tough decisions, the management.
Yeah.
Then there's something has to be cut. And so everybody's going to be, all the minority or disenchanted or what do you want to call it, are going to scream, and hopefully their wheel will squeak a little louder and it'll be a little extra. But So really, it all comes back to us as Christians. Are we putting enough fuel in there to be able to carry it out? And I don't think so.
Although unfortunately it seems to be money always comes down to some deciding factor for accomplishment. I feel money is something that sort of helps the wheels go around for a process, but we as a church, if we understand our real reason being a church, quote, capital C for church, we should be doing what God is asking us to do. And as a church doing what we are saying God is wanting us to do and work with all people from wherever they are from, and then our church as our different denominations work within our different parts of our hierarchy and work not only as a individual within our own congregation and changing our congregation's opinions of inclusiveness and working for that force of that hierarchy, that they too in their higher levels change their mindsets in their levels, where like when you mentioned the Pope down, it ends up we are having to stand there and work and stand there saying that those people in those synodical levels, regional levels, national levels, are they going to stand there and make change within their levels to stand there and say that we and they and us, if we are part of what I consider church, we would be able to work without change.
We have just a few minutes left in the formal part of the program, and there are a couple of people who haven't had a chance to speak. The gentleman up there.
I just wanted to say that when we were here back in 84 and 85, there was a young lady here who gave a presentation, several presentations on Native American concerns. And I remember sitting over on the loading dock with her one afternoon, and she was saying that she felt very uncomfortable in the village here. And I said, well, why is that? She said, well, I look around and I see nothing but Norwegian and Swedish flags and so forth. And I see nothing that shows anything about Native American culture. And I think that same thing the gentleman down here talked about, or somebody was talking about, trying to get a certain percentage of people like blacks and Native Americans in the churches. But unless we get rid of some of our Norwegian heritage, you might say, or German or whatever it is, to make them feel more comfortable. Because if you come into if I would go in, for instance, to a black church, and I was the only white person, I've had that experience, it's very uncomfortable. Usually you won't stay. So you have to have something that you can identify with. And I know that was one of the problems that she had here, even though she was here to, present her concerns about Native Americans. She still felt very uncomfortable, even though she had been invited, and people were friendly to her, but she saw nothing around the village that she could identify with as a Native American. I think that would be one issue that we could really start thinking about, and that would be something that we could do. It would be rather simple.
Okay, thank you. So we have time for one more observation or comment?
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to say that although money is often a concern, and things do boil down to economic means at some point, I don't think that hospitality or inclusiveness is often limited by money. I mean, for a congregation to say, we will accept gays, lesbians, and bisexuals, or ethnic minorities, that does not require funds to do that. You don't have to. You don't have to dish out more money for that to occur.
Except if you do it, you're going to lose members.
We increase our membership. We increase that. Our membership has tripled since we became a reconciling congregation.
Well, we lost.
Sometimes that happens. I've got a concrete suggestion.
Okay, this will be the last thing here.
One of the things that's happening in Washington State right now, and in Idaho and in Oregon, is the Citizens Alliance that is working to make, in essence, make discrimination legal against gays and lesbians. And what you can do is write letters to the editor if you see anti-gay stuff that's going in, particularly if it's written from a supposedly Christian viewpoint. Write in as a Christian saying, I'm a Christian and I disagree with that. Another thing that you can do is write letters to the state legislators if you're from Washington State to encourage the passage of the anti-discrimination bill. In your home state, if it hasn't come, if the Citizens Alliance hasn't come there yet, they will. Under some name or other, did two states last year, they're going to do 14 states next year. It's just increasing. So that's something, that's a concrete thing that you can do. And I understand that the Evangelical Lutheran Church actually has a pretty good statement on civil rights for gays and lesbians.